the hate there is in Red China. Then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace and tell me.
Just about.
Hello and welcome to Veterans Voice. Today we're going to be talking to an author who's written two good books that I've read. Aaron Glantz's, and he wrote The War Comes Home, and the first book I read by him was How America Lost Iraq. So we'll be talking to him really soon. But I got an announcement that next month's Veterans Voice moves to a new day of the week, and that will be on every third Friday instead of every third Wednesday of the month. So it'll be on Friday, March 20th at 9 a.m. It'll be the same time, just a different day. So after 14 or 15 years of being on the third Wednesday, we're going to be switching and going to the third Friday of every month. And it's at the same time, 9 a.m. So write that down and keep listening to us, because KBOO is the best station in the world. And also for our female veteran friends, you are invited to join focus groups to discuss women's veterans health care at the VA. It says, we need your input about women's health care at the VA. What is important to you regarding your health care? And the dates and times for that is March 3rd, March 17th, and March 31st, and it's from 12 noon to 1 p.m., and that's going to be at the Portland Vet Center, and that's at 8383 Northeast Sandy Boulevard, Suite 110. And if you'd like to get some more information on that, you can call the Women's Veterans Program Manager, and that's at 503-220-8262, and the extension is 55595. And so that's for our women veterans friends. And next month is Women's Month, and so we'll be having somebody from that Women's Veterans Program on the show. And so if our female veteran friends are interested, that would be a really good thing to go to.
I encourage them all to take advantage of it.
Oh, me too.
You
bet.
Me too.
Also today, up at the VA, it's Welcome National Association of Black Veterans. Date, February 18th from 12 to 1:30 today at the Portland VA Auditorium. And a speaker starts at 12 p.m. And in celebration of Black History Month, we would like to welcome the National Association of Black Veterans Portland chapters, who will be speaking about the history and overview of Black of the National Association of Black Veterans, along with what services they provide for veterans. And the speaker will be a retired Lieutenant Colonel Leland E. Brown will be the guest speaker, along with other members of the National Association of Black Veterans, who will speak about Black history in the military, Come hear the heroic stories of these servicemen and many others throughout our history. And so if you're interested in that, that's today at noon to 1:30 p.m., and that's at the Portland VA Auditorium, and that's on the second floor. On the second floor of the main building,
yes,
and the VA, and it says refreshments will be served, Bill.
Whoa!
And that would be a pretty interesting thing to listen to. And also, Oregon's next big peace march will be in Salem. Stop the wars at home and abroad. Keep Oregon's guard home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's Sunday, March 15th at the state capitol, and it starts at 1 p.m. And if you want more information on that, you can call Peace and Justice Works, Mr. Dan Handelman, at 503-236-3065, and Dan can give you all the information that you'll need on that. But I think it's going to be a long, hard fight. You know, Obama came out yesterday, I believe, saying he's going to send something like 10 or 17,000 more troops into Afghanistan. And that's not going to be a cakewalk.
No, it's not. That's a money pit.
Oh, that is just horrible.
The Russians were there for 10 years and got driven out.
Yep.
Of course,
the British,
partly with our aid, but we armed the
Mujahideen
and the Northern Alliance didn't they call themselves?
Yeah.
And then they kept the guns.
Yeah, they just kept the guns. Yeah. But what's interesting, the increase would come to top 36,000 American troops that's already there, and so Mr. Obama, President Obama, man, he's, you know, he's taken 8,000 Marines from Camp Lejeune, and he's also it's going to be about 4,000 troops from Fort Lewis, mm-hmm. a striker brigade, it looks like. And boy, and one of the things they talk about, they don't really seem to want to count support units in that. They want to say, you know, we're sending combat troops, which, you know, 10,000, 17,000, but they're not adding in all the support troops that they're going to have to send in there.
Yeah.
And if I remember, in Vietnam, it was like for one troop in the field, for one infantryman, it was like four or five or something support troops just to support the guys in the field.
Right.
And so, you know, that's all going to get added in there, and that's just going to make the numbers go high.
Does Blackwater operate in Afghanistan, or do you know?
I don't know, but I'm sure they're probably going to be there. But the whole thing of Afghanistan, man, that's a bad move. That's going to, you know, that's going to, I hope not, be President Obama's Vietnam. He needs to go back and read some of those, writings by Lyndon Johnson talking about, you know, Vietnam, how he couldn't get himself out of Vietnam and how he got taken into Vietnam. And George Bush, you know, started this whole thing, and it's George Bush is the problem. So he needs to be, you know, held responsible for what he did. And
Bush the first was targeted by who was it that? It was Osama.
Osama,
not Osama. The guy from Iraq.
I don't know.
Well, he was supposed to have tried to kill.
Bin Laden.
Bin Laden.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden. You know, was supposed to have tried to, you know, that. You know, Bill, I was watching some Link TV. If anybody has Link TV, that is a good station to watch.
It is.
Link Television.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really good. And I was watching, they were talking to one of these monsters that came out of the Reagan regime. I think it was Reagan or one of those guys. And he said that the decision was after they had the gas embargo. Remember?
Yeah.
You know,
which one?
Odd and even days here in Oregon.
Oh, yeah. That was back in the...
That the decision had been meant then. It wasn't a written down decision, but it was the decision had been, that was getting passed down, that they would not allow anybody to stop the flow of oil to this country.
Uh-huh.
And that's all the first war in Iraq was about, and that's all this thing is there now.
Well, the original crunch was brought on, as I remember, because that we were supplying arms to the Israelis, and the Arab world was kind of upset over that.
So they found our Achilles heel,
yeah,
and which is oil,
yeah.
And so the decision was made in higher, you know, echelons of this government that they were never going to let that happen again.
Well, ever since oil was discovered under their property.
You mean our oil under their property?
Yeah, it's been one war after another.
Oh, yeah.
And
I would just hate to if we knew everything that this government did to keep that oil flowing, we would just be. It's just a horrible, horrible thing, and our troops are going over there now. I mean, you know. And, you know, I remember during the first Gulf War, one of the big things that we were saying was no blood for oil.
Yeah.
You know, and that's exactly what it is. It's still that, you know. And the pipeline going through Afghanistan, out of the Caspian Depression.
Yeah.
You know, the same thing. You know, that's what... Bill, I heard... We're going to be talking to Aaron. Aaron's on... Okay. You know, the thing that's happening right now with in Afghanistan is that with this bombing, the amount and the numbers of civilian casualties is unbelievable, is staggering, and with more troops in there, that means there's going to be more bombing, you know, by us, and that means there's going to be more artillery, you know. H&I, you know, interdiction and harassment, where they just fire off these rounds. They don't know where they're going to land and everything. And the civilian death rate's going to go way high.
Yeah.
And that's you know, that's not winning hearts and minds.
The bombing in Vietnam was so successful.
Oh man, I remember carpet bombing in Vietnam. It was the ArcLight B-52s. That was some of the most horrible things you ever saw. But we're going to talk, like I said, we're going to talk with Aaron Glantz about his, two of the books that I've read who were they were really good books. And I hope that people will go out and get them. And like I said, the first one I read was How America Lost Iraq. And the second one, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And while I was reading The War Comes Home, it just sent me into a tailspin, Bill.
Yeah.
I mean, he Aaron tells the truth.
Yes.
And Laurel, I would be reading it, and I would just stop, and I'd just sit there and just think back about Vietnam and think that what happened in Vietnam to our soldiers, you know, is happening to our soldiers in Iraq.
Yes.
And it's going to happen to Afghanistan, you know.
I'm afraid so.
And, you know, I went to my shrink at the VA a little more often, you know, and this book, because the book, the both these books are just amazing, and it's great. And Aaron, I want to thank you for coming on and speaking to our audience about these two books.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for staying engaged long after your service commitment was up.
Oh, boy. I tell you, that these books, These books are really good. I tell you, I hope people go out and get these books. And I want to talk about I want to talk about both books, but I want to talk about the War Comes Home first. And how did that come about?
Well, I published The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, as a result of my own experience as a reporter in Iraq.
Yes.
I was unembedded in Iraq for much of the first 3 years of this occupation, interviewing regular Iraqi people about their experiences living under America's bombs, and I came home to a country that was not involved.
Right.
Not engaged. And, you know, right now people are more obsessed with the octuplet bomb in Southern California than they are about what's happening to our returning veterans or even the war and how it's going overseas. And so I thought it was a pretty natural transition for me as a reporter, having talked to the Iraqi people in Iraq, now back in America, to be interviewing the American people who served in the war and getting their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it started off as a listening expedition. I just wanted to write a book mostly for the family members of these returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who wanted to know what was happening to their kids. I wanted to write a book for the Vietnam and Gulf War generation so that they could compare their experiences to the experiences in this Iraq war of these young men and women. And then the more I reported, the more I listened, the more I wrote, the more I realized that the book had to be called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans.
Oh, yeah.
Because when our veterans come home, we make them battle for every single benefit that we promise them when they sign up.
Oh, yeah, that's true, because even to this day, I mean, you know, you can go up to, we have a really good VA system up here in Portland, and but to get into the system, it's a battle. But once you get into the system, you know, but boy, getting into the system is, and Bill had a question.
Oh, yeah, well, I was going to say the treatment that I've received at the Portland VA medical facility has just been first rate.
Yeah, it's but, just getting into it.
But so. When I first filed a complaint with the VA back in 78 or 79, I was interviewed by a Vietnam veteran who was working then for the Veterans Administration administration aspect, and he said to me, "It's not our job to help you build a case for your claim."
Mm.
Which is in direct contradiction to the law governing veterans benefits.
This is the way it's set up.
Go ahead.
People don't like the IRS, right?
Yep.
Because the IRS is a pain in the rear, and but if people stop to think, they will understand that the IRS is set up in a way that is much friendlier to the taxpayer than our VA system is to our wounded veterans.
Yeah.
When you right now we're all getting our W-2s, our 1099s, we're getting our tax returns ready. We will send those returns in to the IRS, and they will send us our refund check right away.
Mm-hmm.
Or they will believe us when we tell them how much money we owe them.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the VA, the burden of proof is on the wounded veteran.
Exactly.
And so you have to prove to their satisfaction that you deserve the care or the disability benefits before they give you a dime.
Yep, exactly.
And this is incredibly problematic, because we take our veterans right when they're just back from the war and they're most vulnerable and they're most in need of help, and we throw a gigantic pile of paperwork at them and we hope that they go away. Because if they go away, we won't have to pay for those excellent doctors to take care of them.
Yep, you're exactly right. And it seems, Aaron, with these folks coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, the wounds on these guys are horrific. You know, some of these guys would have been Vietnam; they would have died.
Well, it is true that some of these guys, the survival rate is much higher.
Yeah.
When people point out that we have, quote-unquote, only about 5,000 deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan compared to 57,000 names on the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., the important thing for people to remember is that just because people aren't dying doesn't mean that the war isn't hell and that people aren't getting hurt.
Exactly.
They're just surviving.
Right.
And actually, a lot of the wounds, because the body armor is much better than it was during the Vietnam era, a lot of these wounds are the type that you can't even see.
Right.
So we have people coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is an unseen mental injury. We have about 300,000 veterans coming home with PTSD or major depression.
Mm-hmm.
But we have another 300,000 veterans coming home with closed-head traumatic brain injury, which means they had multiple concussions, and their brain is not physically the same as it was when they left. They have brain damage
right.
that you cannot see. Or, you know, people are carting around these tremendous body armor backpacks, and they're involved in auto accidents. When there's a roadside bomb that goes off, let's say they don't have a concussion, they might throw out their shoulder or back.
Right.
None of these things are readily apparent. These people are not in wheelchairs, but they are wounded.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, indeed.
You betcha. You know, one of the things about the traumatic head injuries is that we heard that the place in Texas that was doing the studies on that was closing down. Did you hear that? Have you heard that?
Well, it was definitely threatened, but what that was related to was that the guy over at the institute in Texas who was doing this, he had the misfortune of being the bearer of bad news to the Bush administration. He was telling the Bush administration things they did not want to hear about the extent of this problem.
Right.
He was not the only gentleman researching TBI in the country, but it shows you how under the previous Bush administration, there was a real effort to minimize the cost of war and make us think here in this country that the biggest thing that we have to pay attention to is Britney Spears.
Right.
And that, you know, it's like a bad dream, but you remember Donald Rumsfeld, he was the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
He said, this war might last 6 days, it might last 6 weeks, and he doubted it would last 6 months.
Right.
And here we are 6 years later.
Yeah. And another thing, you know, when Bush landed on that aircraft carrier and said mission accomplished, boy, that was horrible.
The reason that it's still important for us to be talking about these things that George Bush said and did early on in his administration is that they have an effect on the treatment of our veterans now.
Yes, exactly.
Because of all this obfuscation, he did not hire any doctors or nurses or claims adjusters to take care of this tidal wave of veterans coming home. And people who stood up to him and told him that he needed to do so were fired.
Right. See,
you may remember Anthony Principi. He was George Bush's first Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
Yeah.
He told George Bush that we needed to hire more doctors. He got fired. He got replaced by a guy named Jim Nicholson, who was a real estate developer from Colorado, who had helped George Bush win the Florida recount in the year 2000.
Right.
And this was the system of rewards and punishments over the previous president. And now we have a huge hole that we got to dig ourselves out from under. It's going to take a lot of foresight and leadership from President Obama and his VA Secretary Eric Shinseki. And, you know, the good news is that he talked a good game on the campaign trail Obama did. He had a good record in the Senate. But now, you know, he's in power. And we've seen this movie before where the person talks a good game before he's elected, and then he enters the Oval Office and somehow he forgets all those promises.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I remember the Bushies and all these folks were saying how every year they gave more money to the VA. Well, they only gave the money to the things they had to. One of the things, the discretionary, was the medical. And they, you know, that was like this battle just to get, you know, get them to put more money into the medical part about it.
Well, you know, one of the things that we should watch, one of the promises that Barack Obama made when he was running for president was that we were going to start budgeting for our VA based on how many wounded veterans we had, rather than based on how much money we felt like spending.
Right.
You know, so for example, when you turn 65 and you ask for your Social Security, they don't say, well, we have $100, so that means everyone in America gets 18 cents. But that's our VA health care is rationed that way.
Oh, yeah.
They
for sure.
set the budget, and then on the basis of how much money they are prepared to spend, then they decide how much health care you get.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So one of the things that Obama promised to do was reverse that. He promised to first figure out how much money we should be spending,
mm-hmm.
and then budget according to how many wounded veterans we have.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the things to watch. Another thing to watch, I think, now with Obama to see, you know, what kind of president he's going to be in terms of the care for our wounded veterans is his new VA secretary, Eric Shinseki, could all by himself decide that if you are diagnosed by a military or VA doctor with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder,
mm-hmm.
or traumatic brain injury, this physical brain damage, concussions, that they automatically grant what's called service connectedness
right.
for that. So, in other words, if the doctor says that you have PTSD, the government is going to assume that you got that in Iraq and not in an auto accident in
right.
America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or they're not gonna guess that you got your brain damage falling off of your bicycle. They're gonna guess that you probably got that in that Humvee incident you were involved in.
Right. See, yeah. I like the service connected in Vietnam. You know, What was it? Oh, they just came out with that diabetes is if you come down with diabetes,
it's a given.
It's a given in Vietnam that you got. It's because of Vietnam.
Yeah.
If you have tinnitus in your ears, it's a given that you got it in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I like that. I like that PTSD or traumatic brain injury. That, you know, if you're diagnosed with that, service connected. That's a great, great thing.
And that's something we don't need Congress for that. You know, we don't need a huge debate in this country. All we need is for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to make a rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the past, we've needed Congress for this. We've had a very hostile administration in Washington.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We've needed Congress to ride in there and force the VA to do the right thing.
Right.
But there's no reason why the VA can't do the right thing all by itself.
Yeah, maybe with the new guy that'll happen. But the VA system, you know, I think one of the talking about the traumatic brain injury and PTSD is, I don't know if the VA has enough psychiatrists and psychologists, you know, to take care of all these guys coming back.
Well, you know what? This is another hole that we're going to have to dig ourselves out of, because one of the things that President Bush did, as I mentioned, was people who stood up and said the emperor has no clothes were eliminated.
Right.
So, for example, there was a woman that the VA hired named Dr. Frances Murphy, and
yeah.
her job was to figure out if they had enough psychiatrists.
Right.
And she found that the access to mental health care for our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans was so inaccessible as to be worthless.
Yep.
And she was fired.
Mm.
And the guy, Dr. Ira Katz, who was the head of mental health at the VA under President Bush, you may have heard CBS News did this fantastic investigative report on the number of suicides amongst our
right,
veterans.
That's what I wanted to talk to next. About.
Yeah, and they found out that about 6,000 veterans killed themselves last year at a rate
wow.
of 18 a day.
Wow.
And when CBS News was investigating this, Dr. Katz, we later learned through court documents, wrote an email to the PR person at the VA, and the subject line was SHH exclamation point.
Yeah,
yeah.
I remember
you know,
that.
Don't tell CBS News that 1,000 veterans under our care are committing suicide every month. I mean, sorry, are attempting suicide every month. We have to find some way to spin this first.
Right.
And that was the attitude of the former administration. Don't try to solve the problem. Instead, stick your head in the sand, pretend it doesn't exist, and if some kind of nosy reporter comes around trying to figure it out, you know, then do what you can to make them go away. And so as a result, here we are now, 6 years into the war in Iraq, 8 years into the war in Afghanistan, And only now are we really starting to see the government begin to respond.
Yeah. During my struggle with the VA, I ran across a law, is it Public Law 32 something or other, that says in the absence of evidence to the contrary, that the veteran's word will be accepted. And so there, it doesn't seem to me like there should be any dispute about whether or not the benefits are due. Also,
well, you know, it's very interesting that the VA hides behind this rule when they tell you that you're not allowed to have a lawyer in a lot of these
right.
cases.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
because veterans as a group are among the most discriminated against legally in this system. You could never tell somebody who was making a racial discrimination claim against the government that they couldn't have a lawyer.
Right.
But we tell our wounded veterans back from the war that they can't have a lawyer to fight their claim with them.
Yes.
And the thing that the VA hides behind is they say, well, this is not a legal system. This is a quote-unquote non-adversarial system.
Right.
But where the benefit of the doubt is with the vet. But you see that there are currently 600,000 veterans waiting to find out if they're going to get their disability claim processed.
How many did you say?
600,000.
Jesus.
And that the waits, on average, in a good situation, are 6 months to 2 years.
Wow.
And if you get in a fight with the VA, if you disagree with their initial decision and you decide that you're going to appeal, then the wait is on average 4.5 years.
Wow, we're talking.
And so, if the system worked the way the IRS worked instead, which is you file your claim, you get your benefits, and they come back later on and audit you, this whole problem could be very easily solved.
Yeah.
But what would happen if they did that would be that these veterans, instead of like not having access for years while they're fighting or maybe giving up and never getting the services, would all be in the system and all costing us money. And then our country would really have to deal with the fact that we have 1.8 million Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans and that 600,000 of them are coming home with PTSD or TBI. Mm. And they would be feeling, as a country, we would be feeling the full cost of that. And I don't think the American people want to engage in that kind of thinking.
Yeah, I don't either.
Well, I think that the American people have been persuaded that the VA takes care of the situation and they wash their hands of it.
Yeah.
I recall, if my memory serves me right, there was a decision made by the Supreme Court, and I think it's called the Ferris Doctrine, which says something to the effect that you can't bring suit against the government. And that's the last thing that the government wants, is to get into court, because they don't want a jury to hear some of these cases.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I write about it in my book, this lawsuit, Veterans for Common Sense versus the VA.
Oh, yeah.
That happened last year as a class action lawsuit. That's the lawsuit where this memo came out, the Shh memo that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That came out in that hearing. And I sat in the courtroom for 2 weeks while they were making their arguments back and forth. And at the end, you know, the VA lawyers got up there and they told the judge, listen, this is what the VA lawyers said. They said it is immaterial that 18 veterans kill themselves every day.
Ugh.
That is immaterial, that the judge shouldn't even consider it, and that the judge should only consider whether or not he had jurisdiction in the case because of this Ferris Doctrine that you're mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
And that as a result of this argument, the judge, who was very sympathetic to the veterans who were bringing the suit, he actually sided with the government because he said even though the veterans were right legally, they had no standing to challenge.
Wow.
And he threw out the suit. It's on appeal now, and like everything else in this kind of struggle, is dragging on for years.
Yeah.
And that's why we need some executive leadership from the new president, because that's the only thing that's going to solve this problem.
Yeah. We're talking to Aaron Glantz, who's written this wonderful book called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against Americans, Veterans. And we're on KBOO 90.7. And I want to talk again about, well, did you meet Paul Sullivan?
Yeah, Paul's a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, Paul. We've known Paul since the first Gulf War. He's a great guy. He's a great guy. You know, when you talk about the suicide rate,
mm-hmm.
you know, amongst veterans, we have that here in Oregon, you know, and it's a really big problem. But with the mental health being cut back so far, how do you when you talk to these Iraqi veterans, these Afghanistanian veterans, what was their thinking about how do they plan to go about this? Because Iraqi Veterans Against the War, you know, they're coming out pretty hot and heavy on this. When you talk to these veterans, you know, what's their feelings?
Well, you know this very well. Veterans are a sample of our country.
Mm-hmm.
And so veterans come back with all kinds of political ideas about the war that they fought in and all kinds of attitude about the government. But they all, unfortunately, end up in the same fight with the government for their benefits when they're wounded.
Right.
And, I think that one of the issues that we face is that the country is not really engaged in this war. And so we have people coming back to their communities, and they're just being forgotten about. And so they have to raise their voices so loud to be heard. I was at a forum in Washington, D.C., a few months ago, where Ken Burns was screening his documentary series, The War, about World War II.
Right.
And there was a panel discussion afterwards, and there was a World War II veteran, a Vietnam vet, and a Iraq War veteran up on stage. And the World War II veteran said, when I came home, they welcomed me with open arms. And the Vietnam vet said, when I came home, they spit on me.
Mm.
And the Iraq War veteran, who was an interrogator at Abu Ghraib, he said, when I came back, nobody was interested. You know, nobody wanted to listen to what I had to say one way or the other.
I had the same problem when I came back from Korea.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you've talked to these veterans, did you talk to their wives?
I do talk to their families.
Yeah,
also.
Talk about that.
Well, I think, first of all, there are a couple things that are different and unique about this war.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the incredible deployment of our National Guard and Reserve.
Yeah, yes. We're fighting that here in Oregon right now.
Yeah, and so the average age, here's some things for people to consider. The average age of our National Guard and Reserve deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan is 36.
Wow.
And so a lot of these folks who signed up, you know, to help in the case of a natural disaster or be weekend warriors or, you know, just get some money for college and feel patriotic and are now being sent over to the war, I mean, they have kids and families to take
care
of.
Sure they do.
And you know, they're well established, and they have mortgage payments.
Right.
And they have, you know, these people are not 18, 19 years old. They have credit card debt that they have to shoulder. And when they get deployed and they're suddenly making $25,000 or $28,000 a year, because that's what their rank entitles them to make while they're deployed, instead of the $50,000 or $60,000 they were making at their day job, they can no longer make those mortgage payments. They can no longer pay those credit card debt. And in the meantime, their son or daughter is wondering, what happened to Daddy or what happened to Mommy? Why have I been abandoned all of a sudden? You know, so I talk in my book about this one family from Illinois, where the Beiersdorfs, where Will Beiersdorf was in the National Guard. He was sent off to guard detention at Guantanamo.
Yes.
And they had tremendous support from their community.
That's a good story.
Yeah, their community really stepped up for them when the government didn't. And now they're giving back, and he's a marathon runner, and they're doing marathon runs for other vets and other families to help them get into the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, which is one of the best places
now that,
in the country.
Talk about that. Talk about how that happened, that he got sent there. That is such a remarkable story.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that remarkable that he got sent to Guantanamo. I mean, he was in the National Guard. He was patriotic. But what was remarkable and upsetting about it was that his boss refused to pay the difference between the amount of money that he was making in the military and the amount of money that he was entitled to at his old job.
Right.
And so he was working for a company called Siebel Systems, which is based in the San Francisco Bay Area, which was going after all of these lucrative Homeland Security contracts after 9/11.
Of course.
And yet they would not pay their own employees, you know, not their whole salary, but just the difference between their deployed salary and their regular job.
Right.
In the meantime, he has a bunch of kids. You know, he has a wife. His wife had not been working because they had more than one kid. She was a stay-at-home mom. She had to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the parents were used to having their mom all day and their dad in the evening suddenly don't have either parent around.
Right.
You know, and so these are the things that our National Guard and Reserve go through, and that's very different than the Vietnam War or some of the other wars.
Right.
Yeah, it strikes me as ironic. During the Vietnam War, they were talking about it would be the budget and how much the war was costing, and it was bleeding the economy. And one of the sayings was it would be wonderful if the Pentagon had to have a bake sale in order to buy a bomber. But what you have now is you have a bake sale in order to provide for the families of the people that we ship off to these awful places.
Yep.
And that is just embarrassing to me, and it just makes me ashamed.
Yeah. The one thing in your book, it says 42%, you're talking to Afghan and Iraqi vets, 42% told the researchers they felt like a guest in their own home. 22% said their children didn't act warmly toward them or were afraid of them, and 36% were unsure about their role in a regular household responsibility.
Well, this is why I started writing the book in the first place.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even though I didn't have a family at the time that I returned home from Iraq myself, I still felt very isolated.
Sure.
You know, because you have just gone through this incredible experience that makes you very, very different than all the people that you used to be close to before you were deployed.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it's the same if you're a journalist.
Exactly.
You know, because you're looking at, or an aid worker or a civilian who's caught up in this.
Right.
You know, and then the difference is the civilians have to stay there. Those of us who go and come, we come back. I came back to Los Angeles, you know, to a family that was exactly the same as the way that I left, but I was different.
Right, you were the different one. You know what? When in your first book, How America Lost Iraq, you were talking about when you would go from Iraq up to Kurdistan.
Yes.
And how that much different the difference was.
And yeah.
That, you know, that's just amazing.
Well, and even now, you know. And I talk about this in the conclusion of The War Comes Home. When I was in Baghdad, I was lucky because as a journalist, I was not under contract with the military, and I did not have to stay forever and ever and ever as long as they wanted me to.
Right.
And I could not be redeployed against my will. And all of these things that are happening to our fighting men and women, where they're being forced to do 2, 3, or 4 tours, I was over there on 3 separate occasions. Over a 3-year period, but in each of those occasions, when I felt like it was too much, I got to come home.
Yeah.
I made that decision.
You know, one of the things I was trying to find, you were talking about the soldier that got wounded in Iraq. He went to Fort Knox or something like that, and then his family found out about the hospital in Chicago?
Oh, no, you're mixing up 2 stories. I told
okay.
2 stories, one of them about Fort Knox. This guy started, this is after the Walter Reed scandal broke in the Washington Post.
Right.
About the deplorable conditions at our flagship hospital down the road from the White House.
Yeah.
But I think that what many Americans don't understand is that Walter Reed is just one hospital.
Right.
It's just one facility. And it's the best.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a scandal that the best facility had such problems. But what about all the people who get sent to other facilities
right.
that aren't lucky enough to have the Washington Post as their hometown newspaper?
Right.
So I talked about G.J. Cassidy in the book. He was in the Indiana National Guard,
right,
served
that's
in
it,
Iraq,
that's it.
And he came back with a traumatic brain injury, one of these physical brain damages caused by the roadside bombs.
Right.
And because of the Walter Reed scandal, the Pentagon created what they call wounded warrior units. And this is where you're still in the military. They want to keep you on the base and get you the medical care so you can get better. And your mission, because when you're in the military, you always have a mission. Your mission is just to get better. So he was in one of these flagship programs that the military is always putting out press releases about. And he died at Fort Knox in Kentucky in this military hospital.
Mm.
And nobody found him for 3 days after he died. And in fact, it would have gone on possibly longer, except for his family kept calling the base saying, "We haven't heard from our son. Can you go in and check on him?" And finally, they went up to his dorm. They opened the door. They looked, and he was sitting in his chair, and all of the blood in his body was pooled in the lower half of his body because his heart hadn't been pumping for so long.
Wow.
And, you know, it's criminally negligent.
Yep.
But... the negligence goes all the way to the top because, like we were talking about earlier, the Bush administration refused to hire enough healthcare practitioners
right.
to take care of people. So we have all these wounded veterans coming home, some of them still in the military, going to these bases where there's a press release saying there's a wounded warrior unit, but guess what? There's no nurses in the wounded warrior unit.
Right.
You know, and so, and the military has, you know, as you know, they've had this horrible recruiting crisis in general, and that's why whenever you watch a football game or a movie, you have to sit through an ad for the military now.
Yep.
This recruiting crisis has been especially acute in all the healthcare professions, because it used to be that, you know, patriotic Americans who wanted to be a nurse or a psychiatrist or a doctor might sign up for the military. But now, if you're a psychiatrist, you're not only looking at taking a huge drop in pay to go work for the government, you're also looking at the possibility of multiple deployments to Iraq. So you're sitting there at Harvard, you know, psychiatric school, and you're saying, should I go into private practice and make $800,000 a year, or should I go work for like one-tenth of that for the government? And then that was already a tough choice for you to make, to put your own service ahead of your own, you know, selfish interests. Now you also have to weigh against the fact that you might die.
Right.
And it's just, you know, these are people with education and skills, and, you know, even if they feel like they want to do a service, they might do it part-time on a pro bono basis instead, and that means that those services aren't available to the people, you know, at the U.S. military facility itself.
Yeah. What, you know, I want to, you know, I want to go back to the suicide. Do you know what the breakdown of suicides between male and female?
I do not, but I can tell you that the incidence of PTSD is much higher amongst our female returning veterans.
Wow.
It is substantially higher, and as Nicole Gordon, you know, explained to me, she's one of the veterans that I profile in The War Comes Home.
Right.
You know, she was stationed at Camp Victory, which is near Baghdad International Airport. It's a big base, and there had been a number of sexual assaults on that base by the male soldiers against the female soldiers. 15% of our women in the military have been sexually assaulted. And she was not one of the people who had been sexually assaulted, but she knew that those assaults had occurred on her base.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said to me, "I'm over here, and I have to not only watch my front to make sure the enemy doesn't kill me, but I have to watch my back to make sure that my own, you know, people who are supposed to be watching my back are not attacking me."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and then you come home, and also, you know, as you know, the sense of community is so important when you come home.
You bet.
It's so important to be able to be with other people who shared that same experience as you did.
Mm-hmm.
And for our women veterans, there's just, you know, 10% of the fighting force is female, which means that 90% of the veterans are not.
Right.
And so 90% of the veterans cannot share that same story with you, so it's much easier to feel isolated.
Yeah. I heard somewhere that they in Iraq, I think it was Iraq, that an American female soldier was found dead, and she'd been shot by a contractor, and they found her in the contractor's living area. Did you hear anything about that?
I do not know about that specific incident, but there's been a number of troubling incidents that you know are investigated as individual incidents, but we don't really look at why they're all happening. And there's a lot of executive finger pointing going on.
Of course.
You know, because, for example, at this Camp Victory west of Baghdad, where a number of women were assaulted, there were there was a problem also with the bathrooms. The male bathrooms were very well lit, and the female bathrooms were not well lit, and so the female soldiers felt like they couldn't go to the bathroom when it was dark, and so they would avoid drinking in the afternoon so they wouldn't have to use the toilet at night.
Yeah.
And as a result, a number of our female soldiers died of dehydration at that base.
Yeah.
And when this happened, the head of the base, Brigadier General Janis Karpinski, pointed the finger at another general who was in Kuwait who was in charge of supplying, and she said, he never sent me the supplies. And then, you know, he then pointed it back at her. And I'm saying, you two generals, one of you can't, like, find a light bulb? Give me a break.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So did have you, are you going to, are you thinking about going to Afghanistan?
No. You know, I think that, you know, for me, I've spent 3 years on and off in Iraq, and that's enough.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have the utmost respect for the people going over to Iraq and Afghanistan and doing this important work. But, you know, I think this whole business about multiple tours being bad for you is bad for journalists, too.
Oh, I do, too. And that's what I was going to ask
you. I remember I was talking to a friend of mine, Fariba, who's an excellent Afghan journalist. This was in 2003. At the beginning of the war in Iraq, and she had already been in Afghanistan for much of the time since 9/11.
Is she the Japanese reporter?
No,
Korean?
She's an Afghan-American journalist.
Oh, okay.
And she was saying to me, Aaron, I noticed that all of the career war reporters are incredibly screwed up. They're all drunk and they don't have a family life. And she said, you're going to have to decide whether or not you want to have a personal life or you want to be like the best war reporter in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked around me, I saw the same thing.
Right.
I see that some of the best reporters out there are you know, their personal lives are not together.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, just reporting on veterans here at home, you know, you said, you know, when you read the book, it triggered a lot of things.
Ooh.
For you.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can just imagine what writing the book was like for me.
Yeah. Have you gone, you know, this is a pretty personal question, but have you gone through counseling?
You know, it's funny. I'm actually talk about this a little bit in the book. I didn't do any counseling right when I came back from Iraq because I had the opportunity to write a book, How America Lost Iraq, where I got to really express myself very well. And then I got to go on tour and I got to do all these interviews like we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in and of itself a great type of therapy.
Yeah, you bet.
I'm kind of going through it all over again with this thingamajig.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, I was in your book. You talk about you went to Vietnam.
Yes, I did. Also,
tell me about that.
Well, I mean,
was it on a job or?
Yeah, I mean, my wife is Vietnamese American,
right?
And I'm a journalist, and she's a journalist, and so you know, it was an interesting thing because it just so happened that in between my trips to Iraq, I went to Vietnam. I went to Vietnam in 2003,
mm-hmm.
in the summer into the early fall, and I went back in 2005 in the winter,
mm-hmm.
and into the early spring of 2006,
mm-hmm.
After my final trip to Iraq, and. You know, I guess what I can say, having looked at Vietnam, you know, not being there at the time during the war, but seeing it now 40 years later,
mm-hmm.
I can see that it's really bounced back.
Yes, it has.
You know, and mm-hmm. And I think that the lesson to be learned by looking at Vietnam now is if we leave Iraq, Iraq will eventually bounce back once we stop screwing with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it will take a long time, and there will be some very unpleasant things in the meantime.
Right.
But if we, the most productive thing we can do is let them rebuild their own country.
Exactly. And the people of Vietnam are so nice and so caring. And, you know, I go back a lot. And, you know, they know I'm a veteran of the war, and you know, they're really nice to me. And that's a pretty good feeling, you know.
Yeah, the form of government that they established in Vietnam after the war has a lot to do with their prosperity now, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, we have to ask ourselves, I mean, this is something that I've really, you know, begun to think about is, you know, You've had the opportunity to go back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It took decades for that to happen.
Oh, yeah.
And just like it took decades for the government to admit that Agent Orange caused all the cancer and birth defects and all these things, it took 26 years for the government to admit that. It took 17 years for the government to admit that Gulf War Syndrome was a real problem.
Exactly.
And now that we've been through all this, we kind of know the game. And so I feel like, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do with the book is get us ahead of the curve this time.
Yep, exactly.
You know, so we don't have to wait so long to get the things that we know are that we already know the story.
Yep.
So can we please just speed it up a little bit?
Yeah. We're talking to Aaron Glantz, and he's written his wonderful book called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against American Veterans. We're out of time, and this went so fast. There's so much more we could talk about. And I want to really thank you for writing this book. And I want to thank you for the first book, How America Lost Iraq. And, you did a great job, my friend. And you're definitely a friend to veterans. And I want to thank you for being on our show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for making the time and keeping the airwaves open for this kind of discussion.
Okay, buddy. Hang in there.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye. And that was Aaron Glantz. And if you get a chance, read The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against American Veterans, and also read his first book, How America Lost Iraq. And I want to say one more time that we're changing our day. Next month, Veteran Voice is going to be on the new day. We'll be on every third Friday instead of every third Wednesday of the month. So next month, tune in at the same time, 9 a.m., but on Friday, March 20th. And from then on, we'll be on the third Friday of every month. And we want to thank Tammy, and we're out of here.
Wonderful job, Tammy.
Wonderful job. Oh, I marched to